From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
As of this moment, Governor DeSantis isn't officially in contention for Department of Defense Secretary, but it sounds like that could change in a heartbeat.
We need a military that is focused on being lethal, being ready, and being capable.
Also this week, a once venerated organization that fights domestic violence is struggling to recover from its former boss's misdeeds.
The shadow that's been cast because of lack of integrity about how that organization was run.
We'll also learn about one man's lonely struggle to toughen Florida's laws against distracted driving, and also learn that not all of the water that's rising nowadays is the visible variety. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report. On Capitol Report, as we sit here, heading towards the late hours on a Friday afternoon, we're still waiting to see if there is going to be a change in the main contender for U.S. Secretary of Defense. So far, whether the Trump administration may swap its initial pick for Defense Secretary to Governor Ron DeSantis. So, that being said, we bring on board Capitol reporter Tristan Wood to talk a bit about how those discussions and conversations are going, as well as what it could mean for Florida, because that's what we're all about. So, hey, Tristan, why is DeSantis being considered for the role now?
So, Tom, Trump's previous pick, Pete Hegseth, is hitting roadblocks behind the scenes due to concerns about his lack of experience. He served in the National Guard and had military deployments, but he lacks experience as an administrator. And as well as there's concerns that have emerged about past substance abuse issues and sexual misconduct allegations. So that behind the scenes seems to have made some Republican senators hesitant to back him. Now, on the other hand, DeSantis is still a political figure really popular in Republican congressional circles. He served in the Navy, spent years on the Foreign Affairs Committee when he was a U.S. representative, and he also has experience managing the third largest state in America. So when people, political watchers are looking, they're seeing a common sense solution to swap for Hegseth.
There still, however, may be a fly in this ointment because, as we recall, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis ran for president against Donald Trump initially during the primary. Is there still some bad blood between the...
Yeah, there's still heavy concerns about that. Here is, in fact, what Trump said about DeSantis while they were running against each other.
The problem with Ron DeSanctimonious is that he needs a personality transplant, and those are not yet available. Almost all congressmen and women that served with him and knew him well supported me. Some of them, surprisingly so, because of their relationship with Ron.
But if he is ultimately selected, that could go a long way to squashing the beef, at least between him and Trump.
Okay. How would he proceed, do you think, with being Secretary of Defense? What would he be like in that gig?
So he would make kind of the anti-woke political messaging that he's done frequently during his time as governor of Florida core to his work in that Secretary of Defense role. When he was running for president, he said that would be one of his foreign policy focuses. Here's what he said during a political rally when he was running for president.
So we need a military that is focused on being lethal, being ready, and being capable. And if there's anybody's agenda that gets in the way with that, that agenda needs to take a hike.
So it likely means he will bring that to the role if selected. That includes targeting and banning diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in the military, as well as targeting LGBTQ representation there. Aside from kind of what he'd do in the role, this would also have tremendous political implications for DeSantis himself. If he stayed on as governor, he'd be out of office in 2026, about a year before a Republican presidential primary would start gearing up. So this would allow him to stay in the spotlight if he holds on to the role up until he would throw his head in the race there. Of course, being the second in command of the largest military in the world, I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
If he gets that, though, That means he will no longer be Florida governor. And what does his absence in that role, if he goes on to D.C., what does it mean for Florida?
So it continues this kind of revolving carousel we've seen in Florida because of all the appointments from Florida to the Trump administration. Currently, several different U.S. representative races are headed towards special elections, the CFO position, U.S. Senate position. And then if he goes, the governor's office would all be vacant. That would create a situation where Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez would ascend to governor, and that would make her Florida's first female governor in Florida's history. But before DeSantis leaves the role, there could be some horse trading behind the scenes for the other appointments. One of the main pieces of speculation with all this is that Trump wants his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, to be tapped for the Senate job. So who ends up filling out those other roles is also of high importance in these coming days.
Capitol reporter Tristan Wood, thanks for joining us on Capitol Report this week, Tristan. When Tiffany Carr, the former CEO of the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence, turned herself in last year on charges relating to grand theft and a scheme to defraud, domestic violence shelters and advocates were left to pick up the pieces. Now Amanda Price, who heads the nonprofit that was created to replace Carr's organization, is leading the cleanup effort. We get more on that story from Margie Menzel.
Price uses words like horrific and egregious to describe the legacy of Tiffany Carr. Carr is charged with defrauding the organization she ran. She's accused of amassing and then cashing in on hundreds of days of paid time off, amounting to more than $3.7 million that, as a result, didn't go to people in dire need of protection and services. When she heard about it, Price says, she was astounded.
It was so shocking. I remember thinking that just can't be true. Like, they probably just don't have, you know, she's going to like be able to explain, no, let me just explain to you how it actually works. You know, I really did think at the time, like, I'm sure this is just, I don't know, a paperwork issue or something, you know, right when it first happened. It was just too egregious.
After reports broke about Carr's actions and law enforcement launched an investigation, the state severed its contracts with the coalition. In 2020, the coalition was dissolved. 2 years after that, the state's local shelter directors started the Florida Partnership to End Domestic Violence and hired Price as CEO. She says there have been many challenges.
That trust and reputation is damaged forever. I mean, that's going to be something that takes, you know, I don't know how to measure that. Is that ever going to come back?
And Price isn't the only one who feels that way. Emily Mitchum is the executive director of Refuge House, the shelter program that serves Florida's Big Bend.
The shadow that's been cast because of the lack of integrity about how that organization was, whatever you want to call it, run, that cast of shadow still is a challenge for all of us, I think. It was so shocking to see that an organization that's supposed to help the most vulnerable people operated in that fashion.
Now, every employee, board member, and bylaw at the Florida Partnership to End Domestic Violence is different from its predecessor. The former coalition was a thoroughly top-down organization. This one has an egalitarian structure, with a board that's responsible for watching the money and a program council that designates the services that the Partnership to End Domestic Violence provides. The State Department of Children and Families is the funder, certifying the shelter programs and monitoring them. FPEDV provides support, technical assistance, and training. Price says things are better, but
we're still cleaning up. I mean, it's been 2 years. This is the first interview I've done because we really focused on building the house and not, you know, going out and telling everybody we're fine, everything's great, because we weren't.
The partnership's efforts are needed. According to the State Department of Law Enforcement Uniform Crime Report, in 2020, there were more than 106,000 domestic violence offenses reported to law enforcement. and 217 people died due to domestic violence, representing about 20% of all homicides in Florida. I'm Margie Menzel.
As pressure has increased for the state of Florida to allow bear hunting for the first time in nearly a decade, Florida wildlife officials will get an update next week on the state's black bear management plan. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission will receive information about the 2019 management plan during a meeting that's set for Wednesday in Lakeland. A memo to the commission from Melissa Tucker, Habitat and Species Conservation Director, said the state has more than 4,000 bears and that the agency receives more than 6,000 calls a year about bears. The presentation said an average of 300 bears are killed by vehicles each year, and despite best efforts, on average, one person each year is injured by an encounter with a bear. Coming up on Capitol Report, one of the state's most respected former Republicans shares his thoughts on the recent election.
But of course, the first time somebody talked about the swamp and draining the swamp was Benito Mussolini.
Florida still has a lot of condos in a state of crisis, but it doesn't appear state lawmakers will be making a special trip to Tallahassee to solve the problem.
It's an issue we'll be discussing during session. We're almost there. In January, we'll be in committee weeks, and the condos will be a part of that discussion through the committee process.
A father who lost a son to a distracted driver is determined to see Florida pass tougher laws against cell phone use by motorists.
Georgia has a really strict law. It's really good. It's like you can't touch your phone while you're driving. That's where we need to be.
And it seems the water isn't rising only in the oceans. The water that's beneath our feet is on the rise as well.
It's more dramatic, it happens during hurricanes, but that water table is going to rise through time also.
Max Stepanovich was an architect of Florida Republicans' rise to dominance decades ago. But the veteran political operative left the GOP after President-elect Donald Trump took over the party. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast, Stepanovich dissects the Make America Great Again movement, and here's an excerpt.
You're now an NPA.
Correct.
What's the difference between the MAGA Republican Party and the Reagan Republican Party?
The Reagan Republican Party was composed of Republicans, conservatives in the old Edmund Burke sense. The MAGA Republican Party are actually rhinos. They're Republicans in name only. They are right-wing populists, and that's not the same thing as a conservative.
How is that different?
Conservatives believe in conserving, which is where the name came from. So they view rapid or revolutionary change, take a dim view of it. They believe that you should adhere to the old values, and that to the extent that they change slowly over time without any starts and jolts. And in a sense, and I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking about this since the election, in a sense, the MAGA Republican Party is the very opposite of conservative. I mean, they're looking for a revolution. They're going to get rid of the education department. They're mm-hmm. going to sack the FBI. They're mm-hmm. going to hang all of the public health people.
I mean, I'm being deep state.
Yeah, I'm getting being
it's
facetious.
The deep
they're
state.
Going to drain the swamp, which I, by the way, and I never know whether these things are intentional or they're just intuitive. But of course, the first time somebody talked about the swamp and draining the swamp was Benito Mussolini. But, you know, like I said, maybe it's a coincidence that they use that kind of terminology. And of course,
I don't think, I mean, you can't see him because he's giving me a little twinkle in his eye as he says that. There are people and ways of governing, I'm using air quotes, that Donald Trump has expressed admiration for. I'm thinking of the Turkish
Erdogan.
Right. And, you know, kind of his admiration.
Affinity
even.
For dictators.
Yeah. You know, so even, I don't even think
the,
it's
even the MAGA slogan is, you know, goes back to the 30s. America First was the slogan of the movement, if you want to call it that, in America in the 30s, that was supportive of Germany and opposed any American involvement in the looming European conflicts. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, Thatcherism in England, which moved that country at that time pretty far to the right in the spectrum as it existed then. Literally, Margaret Thatcher wanted to make Britain great again.
So why is that so scary to so many people?
What it may say, and again, I've been thinking about so much since the election that I can't put it in any kind of order.
That's okay, because
I can't
like
wrap
to,
my head around
it. You know what
it.
We call that? Right. Doing the weave.
That's exactly right. I have concluded, I continue to believe that Donald Trump is cunning. He reads people well, and he reads his audiences well, and he knows how to play to them, which doesn't change my opinion that he's dumb as a box of rocks. You know, he's militantly ignorant. But I have about decided that there are some very smart people around him, and that much of what you see and you hear and that you sense about him and MAGA is not accidental. It's not coincidental that they know what they're doing.
That was former Republican political operatives Max Stepanovich on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast. That's a product of the News Service of Florida, and you can hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Florida's new legislative leaders say they don't have plans for a special session on the state's looming condo crisis. Condo buildings are expected to have funds in place for repairs by the end of the year, and condo owners can't afford the costs. Governor Ron DeSantis has said he hoped to address the issue before the end of the year, but as Adrian Andrews reports, during the reorganizational session earlier this month, the new House Speaker and Senate President said lawmakers would take that issue up when they begin meeting in committee to discuss bills as part of the regular legislative session.
Condo affordability has been top of mind for Governor Ron DeSantis for quite some time. He asked lawmakers in September to convene a special session before the end of the year to provide relief to condo owners who are struggling to keep up with the cost of state-mandated building inspections.
I know the legislators are getting a lot of feedback from their constituents, and that's what they're elected to do, to take that feedback and then to figure out what policies make sense to be able to deliver the types of reforms that are gonna help people.
The Florida legislature made several changes after the deadly 2021 Surfside condo collapse. The plan was to bring older condominiums up to code, but condo owners now say they're being forced to pay higher HOA assessment fees to meet the new safety guidelines. When asked about a possible special session to amend the provision, Florida's newly elected Senate President Ben Albritton said it's something lawmakers need to address soon, but he's not convinced a special session is the right way.
We agree with the governor's sense of urgency. We agree that we need to look very closely at this. It is a complex issue.
Florida's new House Speaker, Daniel Perez, made similar comments. He's for making condominiums more affordable for Floridians, but agrees with Albritton that a special session is not needed.
When people call for a special session, they're very quick to pull the trigger on saying special session, but we should think about what is the topic and the solutions that we're trying to solve for in that session. I think we'll have that discussion once we get to January and committee weeks.
Perez and Albritton agree the issue of condo maintenance and affordability will be top of mind when lawmakers gather to begin discussing bills for the regular legislative session. Meanwhile, some lawmakers have planned what they call a condo summit for early December to get a better understanding from constituents about what possible solutions there could be. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Demetrius Branca of Tallahassee says December 7th, 2014 started pretty much like any other day. Not long after he was headed to his job, he says his 19-year-old son Anthony was getting off work and hitting the road.
He was on his way from his morning job to classes in the afternoon on a Friday. He had slowed down to take a left turn on Old Bainbridge Road, and that guy behind him was doing something other than paying attention to the road. He literally hit Anthony, rolled over him, and then coasted to a stop.
Anthony, critically hurt, was rushed to the hospital, where he died soon after.
That day obviously changed my life forever. I can't be the same person I was before that day. The last 10 years have been pretty rough. He was killed on November 7th, 2014, which was just exactly a month short of his 20th birthday.
But as profoundly tragic and life-changing as Anthony's death was, Demetrius says there was no way he could be prepared for what happened to the distracted driver of the van that struck and killed Anthony.
I thought for sure, like, this guy's going to get manslaughter charges, he's going to go to jail, and all of these things are going to happen to him. But it was like a it was a whimper, like a whimper. He got his driver's license suspended for 6 months and paid, I think, $1,000 in fines, and that was it. And then he went on about his business and went on about his life.
In 2015, Florida lawmakers passed a law that prohibited texting while driving. But even a passing glance at other motorists nowadays show many of Florida's drivers ignore that statute. In 2019, lawmakers passed an enhancement of the law. It banned any use of a cell phone in a school or road construction zone. Branca sees those measures as woefully inadequate. He sees Florida as a national outlier when it comes to the laxness of its present laws against distracted driving.
It's something that 31 other states have enacted in this country, and we're like the biggest one that hasn't done it yet. Georgia has a really strict law. It's really good. It's like you can't touch your phone while you're driving. That's where we need to be.
Since Anthony's death, Branca has taken on the crusade of changing Florida law. But before that can happen, he says it's necessary to change attitudes.
So I was going to the Capitol before work to go talk to people and try to change people's minds. And I was met with a magnificent response. The House of Representatives was overwhelmingly for this. Overwhelmingly.
However, the reception at the other end of the Capitol building was quite different.
In the Senate, the holdup was in the first committee, which is the Transportation Committee. That's the first committee it was assigned to. And the head of that Transportation Committee refused to put it on the agenda, absolutely refused it. He blocked it. The vice chairman of that committee was the Senate sponsor of the bill. He wouldn't listen to her. He refused to even tell her why he was blocking it.
And so, with no Senate companion bill in play, the initiative failed. What perhaps distressed Branca more than anything is the fact that the senators who are against the bill just won't talk to him. That includes that pivotal Transportation Committee chair, Nick DeSegle from St. Petersburg. Although Branca says some legislative staffers did say the issue seems to be opposition to police officers looking into people's cars to make sure they're not on their phones.
For some reason, the ideologues or phony philosophers or whatever they are deem it necessary to implement their idea of what's good upon all of us. I was reading one survey where 94% of Florida residents want tougher driving laws because we all see it. We all see what's going on in our streets.
To the point that Branca no longer proceeds into an intersection when the light turns green without first making sure there are no oncoming vehicles whose drivers haven't noticed they now have a red light. Sadder but wiser, Demetrius Branca says he won't return to the Florida Capitol without a lot more backing during the 2025 session. Next week, he'll be meeting with local elected officials, particularly county commissioners across North Florida, for starters.
The people closer to the ground, they understand me, they hear me, and I can understand them. And they know how tragic this is, and they know how preventable it is. And so I think I can rally a lot of support there. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
And this Saturday, the 10th anniversary of his son's death, he'll be hosting a gathering at his Tallahassee home. The idea? To gather financial and other resources in advance of the 2025 Florida lawmaking session that begins in March. Floridians give billions of dollars to thousands of charitable organizations every year, and the holiday season is the best time of year for charities to raise money because folks tend to be in a more giving mood. But it can be tough to tell which organizations use the money for the services they advertise versus those that mainly spend donations on salaries and overhead and others that are outright scams. Attorney General Ashley Moody recently released her office's 2024 Holiday Consumer Protection Guide with tips on how to determine whether a charity is legit or not. Moody says it's a lot easier to avoid bogus charities up front rather than attempting to get your money back later after you've been scammed.
These are wonderful days of family and giving. We want to make sure we're encouraging that, but we want Floridians to be protected and be safe.
In addition to avoiding charity scams, the Consumer Protection Guide has information on product recalls and online shopping tips. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, as climate change drives up the risk of flooding from sea level rise and more powerful hurricanes, one factor in the mix has remained mostly overlooked in forecasts: Florida's shallow groundwater. Now, for the first time, a federal study looks at how rising groundwater combines with other threats to put millions more people at risk. WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich reports.
People have been waiting on this kind of groundwater analysis for a while. 24 researchers started working on it in 2018. While we mostly think of high tide flooding as the biggest risk from sea level rise, the new study by the U.S. Geological Survey found rising groundwater fueled by sea rise is just as bad, if not worse. Along the East Coast from North Carolina to Florida, about $1 trillion in property and 70% of the population could see regular impacts with just over 3 feet of sea rise by the end of the century. South Florida represents the vast majority of that risk because our groundwater sits just a few feet beneath the surface.
We often get fixated on overland flooding. It's more dramatic. It happens during hurricanes, but that water table is going to rise through time also, and it's going to amplify those overland flooding impacts.
Patrick Barnard is a research geologist with USGS and lead author on the study. He spoke from Washington after his home in Oregon got hit by a bomb cyclone with hurricane-force winds. He says South Florida is already seeing the impacts from rising groundwater, including failing septic tanks and western neighborhoods that flood more frequently.
So more rainfall equals a higher water table, higher sea level equals a higher water table. And so we're trying to understand, looking forward, as sea level rises, how will that water table respond as well?
Understanding that means that South Florida will not just need to buffer its coast, but think about how it lives far from the beach as well. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrienne Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm and Jenny Stiletovich. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.